All right, level 20, episode 4, forward. If you got questions for Josh or Friedel or stories you know that I can surprise them with, email those in, podcast@level1productions.com. Real quick, ways to support. Thanks to those who rated on iTunes. If you do that, it helps us out a little bit. We have the Level 1 Summer Sale coming up August 1st. Keep an eye out for that. Going to be a bunch of awesome deals on limited remaining stock. The world premiere of Level 1's 20th movie, Romance, has been set at September 21st. Keep an eye out for that here in Denver at the Summit Music Hall. Tickets will be on sale soon, so keep an eye out, save your pennies. Right after the summer sale, if you are in Denver, also come check out. We're doing a Level 1 ski movie nights here at the office on First Friday. That's August 2nd next month. Come through. We are going to have free beer from Fat Tire. We're going to be showing ski flicks. It's going to be sweet. Check it out. Lastly, tell your homies if you're enjoying the pod. Recommend it to a friend because I think it's pretty awesome, and the whole reason we're doing it is to share these stories and, so help us spread the love. Thanks for listening. Here we go. Episode 4. Forward. Josh and Friedel back in the booth.
Here we are.
We're back.
Let's do it. So, you guys based out of Colorado for this movie?
No. This was still East Coast based. Well, I mean, frankly, Strike 3 and Forward, I pretty much just like hit the road at the beginning of the season and didn't really spend much time in the Northeast. And it was really just on the road nonstop, just crashing with friends, occasionally a hotel or a resort if somebody was putting this up. But we were just on the road nonstop.
Very similar programs, Strike 3 and Forward.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I feel like for you anyway.
For sure. I mean, spring, I think it was actually May of 2003, moved into a place in Boulder. And I was actually dating a girl who was going to CU that winter. So I definitely spent a lot of time hanging out on that campus and actually kind of living in her dorm room for half the year, I think, when I was in town. But yeah, that it was still just full road warrior status for both those years. But yeah, and then things changed. But I mean, that was definitely part of the migration from the East Coast to the West Coast 4 years.
You were heading that way.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Definitely came to the realization that being based out of my parents' farmhouse, the end of a dirt road in Vermont, was not a sustainable place to run a business, and certainly not to make ski movies out of. Mm. So yeah, reality hit. At the same time, actually, my dad had finally retired and they sold their place in New York and we're moving up to Vermont full time. And it's like, well, I'm definitely not living with my parents. That's not going to fly.
So, I migrated west. I did the migration. Manifest destiny. American dream. Go west. Young man.
In a Conestoga wagon. It was really kind of weird.
Oregon trail shit.
No, I moved out there the day after. I moved to Lake Tahoe the day after Christmas 2002 and spent New Year's Eve 2003 in Lake Tahoe with good buddies, Chris Lyle, who's a skier I was filming at the time, and this kid Elliot Russell. And yeah, lived in Lake Tahoe that whole winter working at Kirkwood as a night janitor.
No shit.
Skiing.
Yeah. Mm.
Yep. And then I guess joining up with Level 1 for Parkasaurus.
Yep.
Yep.
Freeze Magazine shifted locations for Parkasaurus from Snow Summit. What was the name? What's the other name of Snow Summit in California? Not Big Bear. Yeah, Snow Summit.
Big Bear, Snow Summit.
Big Bear. Summit to, they moved to it June. To June Mountain.
Mm.
So I was living in Tahoe, so it was only like a 2-hour drive or whatever down there. So, yeah.
Sick.
Yeah, that was my first, like, official Level 1 shoot.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Was it really? That's how you remember it?
I'm
not disputing. I'm just what, saying
it wasn't, that's... but that, it definitely felt like it for a number of reasons. Because that was, like, the first time I was properly introduced to like the ski community as a whole, outside of like the world we had been living on in the East.
Mm.
So, yeah, you went to park and you bought me a camera.
Yes.
So you bought me a refurbished VX2000 used that came to my house in Tahoe probably in early April, maybe late March.
Exciting stuff.
And then that was like that was like officially like now I'm filming for Level One.
I'm on
Before
the team.
That, I was just still filming my friends even in like Tahoe with my Canon GL1.
Hmm.
So yeah.
Well, we got a listener question about Parkasaurus, so since you brought that up, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
Henny VJ wants to know about Parkasaurus and Super Park as well. What were your thoughts on collective park shoots then, and have those morphed over time? In terms of free skiing community building, I don't think you can get much better. That's why West Coast Sessions was so epic. Back then, it was even bigger. Almost the entire free skiing clan would come together in one place and hang out and feed off each other. Are we missing out on these days? And, like, Henny wants to know, and what was that like back then? These big, giant park shoots.
Well, that, in a lot of ways, was the golden era for that kind of thing, where your Freeze Parkasaurus, your Powder Super Park, you could get, I don't know, 50, 60 people together, and it was every person in the sport that was qualified to hit those jumps and those rails. So, like, It was everybody and anybody. It was a who's who of the entire industry. And I mean, in a lot of ways, that's kind of what made it special. I mean, you had your Candides, your Tanner Halls, your C.R. Johnsons, your John McMurrays and Rory Bushfields and Scott Hibberts and Dave Crichtons and Ewan Olsons. And it was every single person that was actively participating on that level. And you obviously can't do that anymore because there are 5,000 kids, 10,000 kids around the globe that can throw down on some sort of reasonable level and probably, you know, 500 that would just tear it up at an event like that. So things definitely went in different directions. And I mean, certainly at that time, park shoots on that level were such an undertaking, both for the resorts and from an organizational standpoint, that the film companies, Level One included, weren't really doing those things on their own. Hmm. And it was an interesting time, too, because you'd have every single one of the major film companies gathering together at these events, and you'd have big chunks of movies and rider segments shot at these borderline semi-public, semi-private things, and a huge overlap of shots. And, I mean, that was just all part of it, but I think that's when all that content started repeating in movies, I think that's one of the things that started to inspire certainly us and I think everybody else at the time to look to take park shoots into a more private environment where you could have more exclusive content that stood out from the rest. But I mean, all that being said, I mean, that was definitely like a magical time and a place. It was really just awesome. And certainly one of the highlights of my year. And, we're going to bring it back.
Fuck yeah.
I want to do a Level One Super Park.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, one more thing real quick. Henny, when and if we do that, not only will I take you up on that offer to film for free, but I'll buy you a beer because I've been thinking about this kind of thing for a while, and reading your email earlier today definitely like pushed me over the edge, and I feel like that's something that should come back. And if we're not doing a feature film next year, that's something that I can actually put time and resources into.
Yeah.
Level One Super Park.
Damn.
Big news.
You heard it here first. We can. Yeah, shout out Henny. Henny's a homie from Vermont, but unbeknownst to me, he had bought my, like, the movies I made in high school, contraband and proof. So, and I think he still has them or something on VHS, which is awesome. But.
In Lucite blocks.
About, like, Parkasaurus and Super Park, like. Yeah, that was the biggest impression I had rewatching Ford. It's like how much of the movie was filmed at both those events, but specifically in Ford, Super Park in Timberline, not Hood. Because that's like half the intro.
Yeah.
No joke, absolutely. Is Super Park. And I mean, granted, that was like such a dope shoot that year.
Yeah.
It was probably one of the best like ever in that I had seen in skiing. I was new to it as well. I had also moved from Lake Tahoe to Mount Hood that summer, that spring. So I was like there for that whole thing, but, and it was like very fucking exciting. But speaking of like the whole community coming together, Liam Downey was also like invited into that world of like, yeah, the Yoons and Tanners and Sages and Candides. And so he was like the rookie dude that year, and it was all these veterans, and he was like the new kid, like there at the spot. Just a crazy feeling, because it felt like he was being welcomed into this family of like 25 skiers or something, like 35 maybe. I don't know what it was, but
something like that.
Yeah,
it's a rite of passage.
Rite of passage. Absolutely. For sure. And absolutely, there was like, yeah, crazy good, yeah, good vibes that have not been replicated until very recently. I think we're like Kimbo sessions and stuff. It's maybe what he's getting at, what compares to it today. Yeah, it would be Kimbo sessions.
Definitely.
But in terms of...
The only problem is just like, you can't have everybody, yeah, as I sort of alluded to. Like, no. And so these things have to be, I mean, they were exclusive at the time, but still like, there would always be like a dozen or so dudes that would, you know, quote unquote, sneak in that weren't really invited, but, you know, they were friends of friends and they could hold it down, but you just can't do that, because now it'd be like 400 dudes sneaking in. it'd be insane. But there is a way to do it.
Were these shoots pushing the limits in terms of like what features were showing up too? There's a bunch of rail transfers in this movie that like rail to rail gaps, and at one point a rail to rail triple.
Yeah, the disconnected trapezoid from Buttermilk, the Poor Boy shoot. So yeah, I mean, that's another thing, is that these things at the time were gathering everybody and allowing people to influence and inspire and push each other, and not only, you know, on the skiing side, but I know for a fact that the guys that are building these features, designing these features, and pushing the snow around, I mean, that was their time to shine and come up with these new ideas and really, you know, push the limits of what was going on.
Totally.
But, yeah, those rail gaps, incidentally, came from, Poor Boys did their own kind of, like, mini super park that year. In fact,
it was a park shoot, like, yeah, a very modern park
shoot. Yeah, but that was probably the first real park shoot that I'd ever seen that was sort of structured in and around a film company. And Poor Boys had a really good relationship with Aspen Snowmass, and they pushed up a bunch of features in snow on Buttermilk. And I mean, I was super friendly with Johnny at the time, and I think I mentioned in one of the earlier episodes that, you know, I was very inspired by him early on. He did a lot for influencing me and the riders that we were skiing with at that time. We were all watching early Poor Boys movies, and that's what kind of jumpstarted a lot of this stuff. But yeah, he was always really cool about helping me out any way he reasonably could, and collabing in some ways. And there are a bunch of things that went on that winter, from our trip to Silverton, which was sort of a collab Poor Boys level one thing, to that, the shoot in Buttermilk. I mean, realistically, it was because I was traveling and working with and babysitting Dumont and Crichton. He wanted those guys to be at his shoot, so I was like, well, you know, I'm with them, so if you want them, then I'm gonna come too.
It's a package deal.
It is a package deal.
It was. That's how we got into the quarter pipe later that summer at Mount Hood as well, because Johnny had set up a private quarter pipe for Poor Boys that Kurt Heine had built, who was filming for, he's like, Kurt Heine's an OG Mount Hood.
It is Kurt Heine's birthday today, by the way. Happy birthday, Kurt Heine.
It won't be when it drops, but.
Well, yes, but today, July 3rd, yeah, it's Kurt Heine's birthday.
But yeah, he, Crichton and Dumont were staying at my house, so it was in Hood. And
like in Gubby, you had a house?
In Welch's.
Okay, word.
So it was like, and, Berners in town were like, Johnny was so damn cool about having us join in and shoot that, because he totally didn't need to be. Mm-hmm. So we owe a lot to Johnny. He's a super good guy. But that was like a big thing for especially this movie, I feel like, because that's where also like Crichton got his all his back to back tricks at that snowmass shoot and stuff. And
absolutely,
that was phenomenal. But I do want to go on a tangent here, because meeting Johnny, I had definitely grown up on the early Poor Boys movies, because that was like what established the new Canadian Air Force and just new school scheme right off the bat. And meeting him at Super Park, and then we shot this Step Up that I'd sort of known about in the, one of the gullies off to the side in Timberline right after Super Park with like J.P. O'Claire, Crichton, Liam. Who else? I don't know. Maybe I forget who else was there. But anyway, like, I remember just like, whoa, we're doing a shoot with like Poor Boys Productions. Like, we're here. Like, we are toe to toe with Poor Boys. Like, this is absolutely, like, we made it. And then, like, I had a very good impression of him as well. I remember I gave him a ride down the mountain into town, and he was, like, such a nice dude talking about, that was the year of Session 1242 that they're filming for, the Oakley movie that has stood the test of time, an epic movie in the chain of ski movies, but he was, like, talking about Pep doing back-to-back 540s and stuff. And
oh, yeah. I remember, like, that conversation.
Oh, my God. This is fucking nuts. I can't even believe I'm hearing this. Like, what is going on? Like, yeah, I was just driving the car, like, trying to be cool.
Geeking,
dude, listening to these stories. And he was happy to tell them, for sure. But anyway, that spring in Mount Hood was a huge one, personally, for me.
Sick.
Getting into it with everyone. But
on the lift at Parkosaurus in June that year, Johnny offered me a job. I was like, hey man, you gotta come work for Poor Boys next year. And I remember being just super flattered, of course, but I think at that point, I mean, forward was we were moving forward. I mean, it's like, well, level one is gonna be a thing, we're gonna try to do this. And it's like, man, that'd be so cool. But, Johnny, I can't do it. I can't do it. Sorry, man. And, but yeah, I remember being just like unbelievably flattered. I was like, that's fucking cool. But,
yeah.
And it's interesting too, because, I mean, there is a limited supply of athletes, a limited supply of marketing budgets. And certainly within all the major film companies, there's a lot of competition, but
overlap.
Overlap, oh, for sure.
Dumont was in like three.
Yeah. But just from the standpoint of just like running a business and there being competition, I will say that, you know, as much as anybody else, Johnny and Poor Boys, they were our direct competitors. I mean, Matchstick and TGR, like, they were kind of doing something else and continue to do something else. But, you know, it was the Poor Boys movies that we were inspired by and wanted to make movies like. And they were our most direct competition, but I always got along so well with Johnny. There was never any kind of like your typical like competitive animosity or aggression. It was just like the most friendly relationship. And I mean, competition is good. I love competition. I think it's great. It pushes people to improve what they're doing. And some of the other people in this industry would always kind of come down on us, try to sandbag and undermine what we were doing. But Johnny D never, ever, ever went that direction. It was always a stand-up dude.
Yeah, I think he was definitely of the theory that, like, a rising tide lifts all boats or whatever, because he was never sweating any competition. I think
he was also just a good guy.
Good dude.
Like,
yeah.
There's a huge difference. Like, you know, he was in this because I think he loved it, and he was doing super well.
Yes, he was. Yeah, Poor Boys killing it.
But yeah, I mean, just like, I think he was genuinely hyped for what we had going on and just great, great guy.
Sick. I got one follow-up question on Hood stuff before we move on.
Yeah.
There's a rail, a trap rail, like over a rock pile, and in the background it says Camp Revolution, yeah. I believe.
Camp Revolution was a short-lived camp in the upper side of Skiers Left on Palmer Snowfield at the very top of Mount Hood. Ski, like the Timberline ski zone.
Is it Evan Divig and the Three Phils?
Yeah. Evan Divig had set it up as, like, I guess almost as a mogul camp, but then they quickly shifted to like a alternative to Wendell's and Mount Hood's ski and snowboard camp as like a freestyle camp. So they had made a half pipe, and they had like one or two little jumps, and one day the Phils are up there doing a bunch of filming. They had started Playhouse Films, I think, that summer, maybe that year, anyway. Mm-hmm. But my brother Emil had come to town for a week to ski in Mount Hood, so we were going up to the mountain every day. I was working at Cascade Dining Room at the lodge, and I would just go up to the hill every day. But I think I went up to Divig or whoever was there to the camp, and they didn't know us. And they didn't know me, definitely not me. But I was like, yo, can we like, I don't know why. I guess I had heard that they were setting up this trap rail over the dirt pile, the snowfield or whatever.
Over the cheese grater.
And I was like, yo, do you mind if like my brother hits it and we shoot it? Because he was like, he was on the cover of Axis magazine. So like, he might have heard, like, I was just trying to give it any credentials. Because he was on the...
Axis, by the way, really quick, was Powder Magazine's little offshoot jib new school magazine, which I think lasted for 2 years.
Yeah, 2 years. It was a really dope magazine.
Yeah.
I really, really liked that magazine, but I was biased, too, because they gave the cover to my brother, a really cool photo, again, by Jeff Winterton. But anyway, they let us go and film there. We helped set that trapezoid up, and Emil hit it, and Phil Bellanger, and maybe John Sims.
Yep.
Yeah.
That was that year John Sims had his first shots in a level one movie. He went on to do a bunch of work with us and years to follow. But yeah, I remember meeting him at Super Park. He was kind of a hot ticket at that point. I forgot like if he won an event or exactly like what got him into Super Park.
I think it was probably local Solomon style.
I feel like he won something.
He could have.
Or did like came out of nowhere and just did really well at an event. And that got him on Solomon, and Solomon got him into Super Park. But remember, he had really good style. He had like a Cork 7, like reverse mute or something like that. And like definitely a different kind of style. And I remember being real hyped on what he had going on. And,
Definitely. But Camp Revolution went out of business like a year or two later. Short-lived camp. But it's hard to compete with the big boys up at Hood. But it was cool. It was fun. But Hood in general, it's funny like how much random stuff we filmed over the years at Hood and how much we need that. Like, moving forward, you just like needed footage less and less, whereas back then it's like, oh, May through August you're like filling in another third of your movie. That's what it was.
Yeah,
straight up. And like even in snowboard films and across the board, I feel like it was somewhat that way too. And how much that's changed. Like now Stefan just asked me this morning, like, why don't you guys film at Hood anymore? Like, I guess, I don't know, but I guess because we don't, A, can't think of anything new to do there, but also we don't need to. We already have so much footage we don't need to, but like then it was like, fair game, man, you're filming as much as possible, and for years to come.
Totally.
I think that also speaks to just, like, the development, the evolution of the sport at the time, where people were actually doing new tricks. And you could get away with hosting a park shoot or a jump and putting it in a movie for 3 or 4 or 5 minutes because there was just so much new stuff being done.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing the snowboard movies. I mean, there's a very kind of typical Mount Hood style step over jump that was specific to what they were building. And I feel like I remember seeing it in a bunch of snowboarders movies, watching with you back in the day, Freedom, just being like, damn, like that's cool. It's like a low impact, like good way to take a bunch of air and not a lot of risk. And I remember when we went on to build some jumps later on at Copper and a couple other shoots, definitely referencing Mount Hood style stepovers for what we wanted to replicate.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess they were making the best stuff.
Yeah.
It was good. Because all those jumps that year at Super Park were good, too. Mike Wilson going absolutely massive.
Yep.
And all that. But anyway, yeah. Hood. Big role.
and continue to for a long time. Yeah. Like
absolutely,
education of style, like that, all of that shit. It's this, you know, new tricks but same features.
Yep. And then we had like two back to back Wendell shoots in 2008 and 2009, which we'll get into.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, let's talk about Creighton's opener because there's a lot to talk about in there. A double segment, crazy, two songs, split up by like 3 months. What went into filming that? What was the thought process behind annotating it on screen?
Sure. So I think as we discussed in the last episode, Creighton really arrived in 2002 and kind of like blew things up in his Strike 3 part. And so going into 2003, shooting for Ford, it's like, all right, we are going all in. Dave Creighton is the best in the game right now, and I'm going to, you know, for lack of a better word, take advantage and give him every opportunity I can. I'm going to go everywhere I can with this guy and, like, just, like, cash in on what he's got going on.
And cash him in, too.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it was a mutually beneficial relationship for sure, but it's like every time I pointed a camera at Dave Creighton, he got a shot doing something and just blew my mind. It's just like, we're going to do this.
He's on fire.
Yep.
Sparks were coming off.
Sparks, literally and figuratively. And we kicked the season off at this Bumps and Jumps event. Because that's another thing. So events were such a big piece of the puzzle at that point because you didn't have film skiers and contest skiers. You just had pro skiers. And they go to events, they go to contests, they film on the side. I mean, I remember back in the day, just sidetracking here a little bit, like going to the U.S. Open, like people would go to the U.S. Open and then go shoot street stuff during the U.S. Open. It's like, oh, everybody's here. Let's go shoot the post office rail in Vail. And that's like what people did. So it's like, all right, yeah, Creighton, yeah, we're going to go to Bumps and Jumps and Steamboat. And when you're not doing the Big Air, the Mogul, or the Slopestyle contest, then we're going to shoot street stuff like all around town in Steamboat. And options were definitely pretty limited, but we actually linked up with a local family, the Kirkpatricks. I think Mr. Kirkpatrick, the dad, was working in the marketing office and was hooking us up with tickets either before or after the event. Happened to have a couple of kids who were huge fans of what we were doing, and they toured us around. Ian and Colin Kirkpatrick. They took us over to the college there and showed us some features. Anyway, to make a long story short, I think Creighton logged like a dozen shots or something like that in 2 days or two different sessions, and then went on to do the same kind of thing in Troy, New York, where he basically shot a street part over the course of, I think we went to Stratton too, so you know, three or four locations, 4 or 5 days, but it was so rapid fire that I felt the need to illustrate that. Where it's like, all right, this is all one day. These things are literally like 15 minutes apart. We're moving from one feature to the next, to the next, to the next. And even at the time, it was crazy because nobody else was doing that kind of thing. Like you spend a whole afternoon or a whole night shooting something to get a shot. And Creighton just like drops in, does a switch butter 2, pretzel 2 on a cheese grater, like 25 stair handrail. It's like, oh, that's never been done before. Oh, now he's going to get both switch lips on that? Okay. Well, then let's go shoot this, like, 45 stair that nobody's ever hit before. And let's just do that, too. And it was just, like, one thing after another with him. And, I mean, it was...
Bam, thank you, man.
It was momentum like I've never seen before or since. And it came to a very abrupt halt in Troy, New York. I think it was probably early January where he was, I think, trying to switch to disaster on a down flat down and caught his tip on the post, maybe by the takeoff.
Yeah. It was the opposing rail.
Yeah.
Because that rail set is super narrow or tight together.
Yeah. And kind of just like flailed through the air and managed to not do serious bodily damage, but put his knee, I think, on the corner of the last stair, and it was enough to
cleared the whole thing.
I know, so close.
Every time I see that shot, I'm like, if you had like another inch, you would have been fine.
Yeah, but anyway, that shut him down for a long time to come, and it was actually like 3 months of him just sitting on the couch, feeling like okay, but not good enough, and he had enough of a head on his shoulders that he wasn't going to to risk doing further serious damage, and was really good about being patient. And yeah, when he came back, I think the first thing we did was go to Newfoundland, which was probably, I think, our first, if you want to call it, international trip where we went on a plane. I think that was the big deal. Differentiating factor, because we've been to Quebec a bunch of times and it didn't really feel international. But to get on a plane, to go travel and shoot skiing, that was probably my first real experience, aside from going out west, which didn't feel like much different. But
anyway, Newfoundland is its own place anyway.
Yeah, this is not at all like
the rest of anywhere in Canada. Definitely not like anywhere in the U.S.
No. So Jeff Witterden set this trip up with a place called Marble Mountain, right outside of Cornerbrook, Newfoundland, and brought along Dave Crichton, Scott Hibbert, Mike Nick, Simon Dumont, and myself to shoot video. And again, I think that was for a feature in Freeze magazine. And we got there at the beginning of April, and all hell had just broken loose. They had just gotten like 6 inches of rain and then like sub-zero temperatures. And I remember seeing a newspaper when we landed at the airport with a photo of a parking lot flooded like up to like the top of the roofs of most of the cars and then frozen fucking solid. And it was like, oh, this is what we're getting into. And the base lodge at Marble Mountain had flooded. Everything had shut down. It's like, oh, there's like nothing for you guys to do here. And it's like, okay. So we spent the better part of like 10 days, 2 weeks, whatever it was, for the most part, cruising around Cornerbrook through all these housing projects, just shooting rails, which, I mean, was really a good introduction to what became these international jib trip destinations that we'd really get into in later years. But I think that was really our first foray into something like that. And we also did a little bit of cat skiing, which was more of a novelty than anything else. And good trip.
There's a sick bonus feature.
There is. Actually, it's funny. I watched that today, and looking back at it, you know, again, we're so focused on the time rider segments. I mean, that's like what I thought ski movies were and had to be. And it's like, oh, this is this person's segment that, you know, I didn't even really think of about the idea of a trip or destination or travel part. I mean, that's what Warren Miller did, and that's not what we want to do. So, yeah, looking at the bonus feature, I mean, that's probably what I'd prefer to see in a ski movie these days, rather than splitting all that stuff up, because, I mean, it gives you a little bit of a backstory, a little bit of context, and a lot of humor, at least.
Right, because it gives a place for all the hilarious stuff that ended up happening on that trip.
And there was a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it.
Some random kids.
The Love Dogs are real funny.
Man.
They really come out. Like, Newfies are a fucking fine breed. They're
fine breed.
They're so funny. A lady talking about her son, like, splitting open her
sternum. It's like, oh, yeah, my sons, they started a hot dog skiing back in the day.
In Cornerbrook.
And, Robbie, he split his sternum open.
So casual, too. Terrible injury.
That sounds horrible. Like, yeah, his whole inside spilled out of his chest. It was really unfortunate, but he's okay. Yeah, I mean, the level of comedy of these people, their accents. I mean, don't they call it, like, what is the terminology they use to, like, refer to the quote-unquote language they speak there? They just call it Newfie.
I think it's Newfie.
I think they just call it Newfie.
But it might be some fisherman talk is what it is.
Yeah.
It's like borderline Scottish or something, but
yeah, it's,
I don't know.
Well, hell of a place. Hell of a place.
Dumont kind of speaks his own language too. There's a shot of him behind some behind the scenes stuff pushing someone out of a bed.
So there's a bar called the Newfoundlander that everybody went to on several occasions, including 15-year-old Simon Dumont.
But he wasn't drinking.
No, I know for a fact he didn't drink back then.
And so he was the only sober one, and he was being a little.
Yep, that's right. Crichton, on the other hand, was not so.
Everyone else is drunk.
That's right.
In that room, except for Dumont, and he was fucking with them.
Yep.
And he pushed a very drunk DC off the bed.
Yeah. Sure did.
Yeah.
It's funny. Did. Go watch Past the Credits. Past the Credits of Forward, because it's in there.
Yep.
Funny shit.
Or if you have the DVD.
Right.
It's not in the bonus features.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Another thing that I definitely remember about that trip is that Mike, Nick, and I hadn't gotten along well for years. So way back in the day when he was a ski boarder for Line, and I rode ski boards for a few months here and there, initially on Dina Star, and I remember actually going to a shoot for Line ski boards. Mm. It was like an advertisement for the X Games, and it was like myself and Mike, Nick down at Mount Snow. This is pre-balance. I mean, this is like 98 or something like that. When 99? Early 99, I think. Anyway, I didn't get along super well with him for a variety of reasons. And I remember, actually, side note, Jason Leventhal, I'd written him a letter after that shoot asking about, hey, man, you know, talk about sponsorship, like, what we do here? And he emailed me back and basically said, like, oh, you've got skier style. Like, we definitely, like, you're not, like, what we're looking for. Like, you got bad style. Wow. Shut me down. But, yeah.
Skier style.
Yeah.
And yep. Skiboard style.
It was, like, inline. It was definitely.
Okay.
Yeah. But whatever. I mean, I definitely came from a mogul background. I think Mike and Nick didn't like that. And they didn't really like me. And they're just like, fuck this guy. But, anyway, fast forward a couple years, and Mike Nick ends up on this trip, and after hanging out for a couple weeks, he's like, wait a second, like, you're a good dude. Oh, yeah, you're a good dude, too. Yeah, can we be friends? it was a very cool experience, and I remember that being a major takeaway, and Mike Nick went on to do so many awesome things for the sport, and I definitely, following that trip, had so much love and respect for him, and yeah, I consider him a very good friend for years, and that's where it came from. If we didn't go on that trip, I'd still probably be
beefing. Let's talk about DeMont's enter segment. There's a bunch of stuff from this trip in it. He takes there's a shed hit.
Sure, that was our last day in Newfoundland at Marble Mountain when things finally started to thaw out a little bit. And we convinced the resort management to plow up a little bit of snow and actually let us do something there. Go on.
I mean, it's really funny watching him go insanely deep on that hit immediately after Hibbert eats a ton of shit, basically taking it to the same place.
Well, Hibbert's 5'11 and Simon's 4'11. So, I mean, it's just like an impact thing. I mean, Simon doesn't have anywhere to go and just lands and compresses and he's fine. But
that's a good point.
Yeah, but I mean,
two very different sized dudes.
Absolutely. But even back then, I mean, DuMont was this little ball of muscle mass and like, oh, flat landing, like no big deal. Took it
so deep. He also has clip on the Silverton Mine backcountry jump.
Oh yeah.
Big build. There's a bonus segment on this too. A big blow up about the build. What's the backstory on that build, and then how does it fit into Simon's part there?
Sure. So, I mean, moreover, like the backstory on Silverton in general. So, I think that was becoming established early on as like a place you could go and shoot backcountry. And we didn't have snowmobiles, and I mean, access was certainly very limited for us. And I remember being in Park City, Utah with a few guys, and somehow.
Probably Steel.
Steel, yeah, I think Steel was probably part of that. Because Steel also shot with Poor Boys, but
yeah,
it became this thing like, Steel is shooting with Level One, and he's also doing some stuff with Poor Boys, and oh, Dumont's with Josh. Like, can we do some kind of collab trip? And there's this guy named Shannon Shad, who was an early Solomon Poor Boys athlete, who at the time was probably in his late 20s. I remember looking at him thinking he's like an old guy. But, Shannon Shad was from Breckenridge, and I think knew the zones and had a sled maybe, and I think might have towed us to a couple different spots. But anyway, long story short, we end up going to Silverton with this motley crew of backcountry rookies and sledding up to like as high as we could get, and then hiking a little bit up further off Red Mountain Pass. And I mean, that was probably my first real, if you want to call it, like, legit backcountry trip. And we had Mike Abrams, who was there covering it for Freeze Magazine, and Cody Reisig, who was shooting as a cinematographer for Poor Boys at the time. And so all of us were just kind of working together. Nate. And Nate Abbott shooting photos, absolutely. And yeah, it was interesting because still, like, nobody really knew what was going on. And it's funny, looking back at that mind jump thing, we're just, like, looking for things that would be cool and interesting. And nobody,
terrible spot for a jump.
Horrible spot for the jump. That landing was straight up south facing.
Yeah, and it wasn't even good to begin with.
No.
I don't think I'm really lined up.
No, it definitely didn't. But, like, looking at that today, it's like, oh, man, like, Simon finally lands that seven. And it just kind of, like, splats into this, like, wet, like, sludge of snow. It's like, well, yeah, I spent, like, the better part of a day building that thing. And I mean, again, we're just all learning. Like, I didn't know any better. Like, if I showed up at that spot now or even 12 years ago, I'd be like, no, like, this is not going to work. But, again, just, like, figuring things out. Like, it was a process. Are we doing this because it's cool? Or is it a good landing? Like, we don't really know.
Looks like a lot more photos probably came out of that than videos because from the bonus segment, Dumont is the only one I saw get, like, a clean make on the jump. Even just, like, any make, regardless of trick.
Yeah. No, that's definitely true. And then Cody Reisig went up and tried to backflip and sublux his shoulder in the process, too.
Ouch. Partial dislocation.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
Was that a pain in the ass getting out with him after that?
We were like 25 feet from the road.
Nah.
It was like literally right off the road. So no, it wasn't that big a deal.
Word. Steel Spence, a couple sick backcountry hits in his segment, switch one and switch five on backcountry step downs, which seemed very progressive for the time. Also, his segment leads into the rail chute inside of a high school, which is wild shit.
Yes. Battle Mountain High School in Eagle, Colorado. Junior Martinez, who I think I mentioned earlier on, if not in the podcast, I think in one of our stories.
Mm.
Junior was a student at this high school and knew that they had a 25 stair down rail in this high school. It was like, oh, this is perfect. I mean, this is what people are sliding out in the streets. Can we get permission to hit this thing? And somehow he convinced the principal or the staff, whoever it was, that they should green light this thing. And we had permission to drag in as much snow as we needed into the school and to slide this rail. I think the only caveat was that Junior had to come back in the spring or maybe even immediately after.
Re-wax the floors?
Well, no. We'll get there in a minute. I mean, it's definitely clear that, like, we are going to scrape the paint off this rail. And I think that's what he had to do. His agreement was he'd come back and, like, repaint this thing. But, I mean, I don't think anybody really thought this through that, yeah, it's, like, 10 degrees outside, but it's, like, 70 degrees in the school. And as soon as you start bringing tons and tons and tons of snow in, it starts melting immediately. So not only did we borderline, like, flood that area of the school, but of course ski edges and skis on linoleum tile and on stairs with, like, I don't know, like, rubber surfacing, just, like, no good. So ultimately we did a fair amount of damage in this process. And I remember getting an email, I think it was either an email or phone call, but I want to say an email from the principal months later being like, hey, you guys never signed any real paperwork. And we didn't. That was the thing. There's no paperwork. There's no, like, there's this, like, Junior saying, come on in. Like, we got it. It's cool. And, like, you know, these people let us into the school.
Insane.
Yeah. And anyway, the principal was like, hey, I'm kind of in a little bit of trouble. Can you sign this, like, predated paperwork that says we had an agreement and liability release from before you did the shoot? Because it really helped me out. And it's like, oh, of course, yeah, you definitely do that. And that was a good time. That was another one of those things that really got picked up early on by all these ridiculous caught on tape, like, wild stunts and whatever, like, reality shows that were.
It really is.
Yeah.
It's the most non-natural place
to go
skiing, period, let alone, like, sliding a handrail.
Yeah.
They actually, like, got, like, every shot of them is, like, so haggard and noisy and like gnarly.
Oh, what is the sound in there?
Travis Rhett's clip is like really solid, but I think a couple dudes are trying lip slides. Derek Finn, Travis, like, seen away, looks like he saw a ghost.
Oh, yeah. His mouth is, like, wide like, open. Oh,
never again.
Yeah. Poor Junior took a couple tumbles down the stairs. Brutal. I felt so bad because it was his idea, and he's the one who made it all happen. And poor dude didn't even get a shot, but we put his bails in there just to help him out. And then Travis got it unnatural and lip slid.
Right.
And getting lip over that thing was insane. Tall rail.
So gnarly.
Insane.
Yeesh.
Yep.
Good shit. You guys want to talk about the big compilation segment or Scott Hibbert?
Let's talk about the compilation segment. That's something that definitely stood out to me on my watch of the movie today.
Mm-hmm, me too.
I mean, that was our first, if you want to call it a friend's part, where we had all this random content that didn't fit anywhere else, and it just felt appropriate to put it all together and just kind of showcase some action, some vibes, some locations, and it was just kind of like a feel-good part.
It's really funny watching that because there's like random time lapses in there and stuff.
Oh, it's just like
Las Vegas. Like, okay. Like watching it, I'm like, why? What?
It's because I went to the trade show in Vegas that year and shot a time lapse out the window.
There's also one that says Stratton, Vermont. That's definitely Mount Hood.
Was the joke, which people were like, what?
You're wrong.
It didn't snow like that this year. Like, well, that's... It's also not a volcano that's completely shook up. But what's the other takeaway, I think, in general, in intro included, but this part as well, is that Ford, I think, is the last Web 1 movie where sort of just like threw in a bunch of everything. Like any shot that we had, just threw it in. Didn't matter who it was. Like just whatever. And, like, I think it was the last of that type. Moving forward, started yet, like, more of a crew that you're really, truly working with. And we had that in Forward, but there's still just, like, wild card people all over the place in the intro and that part. Like, there's a shot of Dash Long in the intro. Or, like, Sage. Or, like...
Yeah.
It just these, like, just left field, like...
Sure. Well, it came from, you know, in prior years, some friendships and relationships with these people where, you know, I knew them and then I get a shot of them from somebody or at Super Park and it's like, oh, of course I want to put them in the movie. Like, that's awesome. But yeah, I mean, that was our answer to it. Friedel's definitely right. Like, as things began to tighten up, like, we definitely had a crew. And we were going more in that direction of being a little more exclusive as far as who we were working with and who we're actually putting time and resources into and actually featuring in a film.
Hmm. Yeah, and I guess we're like trading shots with Poor Boys. Absolutely. And we had like Steve Rosenthal with Volume Magazine. So they would just give us random shots as well. And I think the mentality was like, just use whatever we got. Like,
yeah.
If it slaps, it slaps.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Johnny and Poor Boys that year.
Didn't matter how random it was. Kind of.
We traded a bunch of footage because I think he just wanted shots of Dumont for his Solomon partnership and maybe like one or two other dudes. But in exchange, he'd send me a whole bunch of random 16mm stuff that he'd shot. And there's a shot of
and
Dan.
And that didn't
Dan,
matter who it was.
No. It's like, oh, it's Dan Treadway hitting a really sick cliff and like kicking over a waterfall of slough. Like, oh, we're going to put that in the intro. Like, that's cool.
Or like Ewan Olsen doing a 3 in St. Anton.
Yeah.
It's like... We didn't film that, but anyway, just like went, but
yeah. It was good skiing. It's
interesting to hear because I've noticed a few film clips and wasn't sure if that was you adding film burns as an effect.
Oh, that's real 16. You can really tell in this movie.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough too, Ford was the first year that I put a mask on the top and the bottom of the image to make it 16x9 rather than 4x3. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do that otherwise, or it'd be like stretching it. And
What do they call it, a letterbox?
Yeah, I put a artificial letterbox on it, and I put film grain on it.
Mm.
It's funny, watching it last night with Annie, she's like, it's so blurry. It's like, well, yeah.
It's supposed to be.
Yeah, they did that on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, deinterlace the video. Were you deinterlacing at
that time? Yep, deinterlacing the video. I think that's probably right around the first time that I started doing any kind of color grading, because everything for the most part is automatic. Like, your camera's doing like full auto settings, especially on those VX2000s. And I remember Dave Levin, who was a friend who worked for Poor Boys.
I don't know. Not full auto.
No. Okay, I take that back. Because I take that back. But it wasn't wasn't exposure, but
we were shooting manual exposure.
Yeah. And, okay. And shutter speed for sure. Okay.
Yeah.
But no, you are right. You're definitely,
because it looks way better than like people shooting a auto
video. What I'm thinking of, sorry, is autofocus. That's a thing that we didn't have control over. But yeah, as far as exposure. But I think that was, Ford was probably the first year that I started to do any kind of like rudimentary color grading. Dave Levin, who was a friend who worked for Poor Boys, doing editing and graphic design and like motion graphic stuff, he was showing me like how to do some of this basic stuff. But I don't think I'd done any kind of like color correction or grading prior to that. But that's when we first started, I first started to like think about, you know, the look and the feel.
Oh, you were definitely thinking about it. Because I remember questioning the film grain. I did not get it, why you wanted to do that. I was like, it's making the sharpness of this digital video, which at the time I thought was so damn good, making it weaker. But I still have mixed feelings about it. I get where you were coming from. You wanted to give it the softer feel of film, which it sort of did. And it's not like a terrible thing.
No. I mean, looking back, I probably just would have done like 50% of what I did.
Yeah. You were just, you didn't want the harsh image of digital, especially like when probably you more than anyone was being like directly compared to the 16 millimeter standard, which everyone was doing. So I think you just wanted to be like, we're not these like hack digital guys. Like, we make our stuff look,
it's pretty too.
Sort of the same.
Mm. Yeah.
It wasn't really the same until like a couple years later, but
we'll get there.
Good. Yeah. I mean, VX2000, great camera though. Awesome camera. Awesome camera.
You still have yours?
No, because it was never mine. I had I had the Canon GL1.
The one that Berman bought.
He bought me the VX2000.
And then By the way, I can pick out every single GL1 shot.
Well, yeah, because you made them black and white.
Not all of them.
Not all of them.
A couple of Chris Lyle, a couple of Emil and Tahoe.
Yeah. Yeah, true. That's true.
I can probably just like watch video, random like action sports vids from that point in time and tell you exactly what camera was used to shoot it.
Mm. Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah. GL1, GL2, XL1,
VX2000. Well, the Canon's sensor is so different.
Split
light into a bar.
Yeah,
it would like take the sun and or like a street light and make it into like a vertical bar. Very bad.
not a good look.
But it had a three chip sensor.
Yeah.
So at the time, I was like, whoa,
high tech.
We're living in the future. Better living through technology. Yeah. Anyway, enough camera talk.
Sure. Scott Hibbard segment. 100% slams.
Yes.
Not a lot of makes, but very entertaining.
I think that was the goal.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Scott, actually watching the movie today, did have a lot of makes. He had a bunch of shots in the intro, bunch of shots in the friends part, bunch of shots in the credits, and I mean probably like 8 to 10 shots in total that were makes, and they're all really good. And he went on a lot of trips with us, but he also skied really hard and ate shit a lot. Really, really, really hard. Mm. I mean, it's just kind of like taking things to the next level from what he had done in prior years. And I remember
boosting alley-oop nines.
Like 30 feet out of quarter pipes. Just
that motherfucker is like, was really sendy on alley-oops.
Yeah, and I think it was kind of like a thing that everybody was recognizing. Because again, like watching that movie today, like Yoon Olsen crashes in the woods at Vail on this like wooden jib feature, and I put the camera in his face, and he's like, "Man, like, hope that was up to Scott Hibbert standards." And I mean, that was like a thing. Like, Scott Hibbert went really hard, and I remember we were just kind of messing around with like all of Scott's content, sitting on the couch in my like spare bedroom office in Boulder at the time, and I think it was Steel, was like, we should just make an all, like, crash part. I mean, he was one of my good friends. Mm-hmm. Spent a lot of time down there at that point. It was like, can we do that? And I don't remember, like, where that, like, country joke of a song came from. But we just started to, like, play around with it as a joke.
That's, and it's looped, like, 3 times.
Oh, my God. If not, like, 5 or 6 times. Just kept going and going and going. Yeah, and, like, I remember Scott was actually kind of pissed. We had kind of a love-hate relationship.
Well, he did not know about that part.
Nope. That was a surprise. But
that's fun.
Yeah, I think the last time I'd seen him prior to editing was at WSI, where we had some kind of argument about something, and I came back, and he'd literally thrown every single thing that I own, including my laptop, out of our hotel room into the hallway and, like, dented the corner of, like, it was my office. It was, like, everything, like, level one was this little laptop. And it's just like, fuck you, dude. Jeez. And I was kind of pissed. But,
So what you're getting at is, was that segment out of spite?
Well, no, that's what he suggested at some point, and other people might have thought. But, again, like, we definitely had a little bit of a love-hate relationship thing going on. Yeah. And, no, it definitely wasn't.
No,
it wasn't, like...
I know. Well, I know. I mean, but I mean, your relationship was, yeah, again, like this brother thing.
pretty much. But yeah, when it came down to it, it was like, man, this is actually, like, highly entertaining. Like, and this dude does go really hard, and, like, this is the best way to present this content.
But you went back into the archives.
Yeah, I don't remember where that came from. Like, whose idea that was?
Not just the current crash reel. That was greatest hits.
That was
got hit volume
1, 2, 3, 4 or whatever.
It was, but yeah, but we definitely went all in on that part. It was probably like 5 or 6 minutes long. Same damn country song, just looped. But yeah, I remember he was initially really pissed off and just like, oh, you fucked up my career, like this and that. It's like, and I remember talking to his team manager, he was writing for DNA, subsidiary of DeSant North America, who we were working with at the time too, and this guy Trey Harris, who was a team manager, marketing guy, and Trey was like, dude, Scott's stock just went up like 300%. Like, everybody in the ski industry knows who this guy is and is talking about who this guy is. He's like a grade A personality and just like aspect of the sport. We love him. This is great. And I was like, see, like, it's not, like, people aren't looking at you as, like, a joke. It's like, people look at you as some dude who goes really, really hard.
I guess. He does go hard, but there's, like, some of that where it's, like, 4 minutes deep, like, yo.
Yeah, I mean. Sure, in retrospect, probably could have pulled back on the reins a little bit.
The song doesn't help. I will say it's not the song does not go hard like the slamming does.
No, yeah. But I will say we put every single one of his really good makes throughout the movie. And
if you had to do it again, would you make that part again?
Probably not with the retrospective from prior years. Probably just like keep it to that 1 year.
Yeah,
and just like let it go at that. At 4 minutes of Bales instead of 7.
Oh, it does have that opening shot on the ledge. Double King ledge, concrete ledge.
In Breckenridge.
Brutal. Gnarly.
Yep.
He was, yeah, kind of like pretty metal.
Yeah.
Ever, man. Yeah.
I'm going to give Steel Spence credit for that song.
He wrote some checks to the game.
Yeah.
Yes, like, <he did. laughs> full on.
Yes, he did.
What about Steel, though?
I think I'm going to give Steel credit for that song, though. I feel like that would have come from him.
Could have, yeah. Yeah. It's another wild card in that movie. Like, what is this? The whole part is like left field as it gets.
Got to do that once.
Yeah.
It is. Just as you said, it's entertaining as hell.
Okay.
It is all of that. There's a lot of gold in the credits.
Talk to us.
A cop car rolls up to a spot and says, put your hands up and your shovels down.
Yeah.
Is that the real audio?
That is the real audio. Definitely didn't have it in our, like, repertoire at the time to be, like, dubbing in too much fake, realistic sounding audio. That was legit. The Aspen Cops were a trip. I remember that year at X Games, maybe even the year prior, Red Bull used to host some ridiculous parties. And this was when X Games was a lot smaller of a spectator thing than it is today. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we just used to run the whole town and just go to these ridiculous Red Bull event parties and whatnot. And the cops would always be called. It was always in a house, too, of course. And I remember the cops showing up probably that year and passing out trading cards. Aspen Police Department had their own trading
cards.
Swear to God. Front, it's like a posed photo of Officer Bill Smith in front of his patrol car. And on the back, it's got his stats about, like, his height, his weight, his, like, hobbies, his astrological sign.
His special moves.
His special moves. Like, taser to the gut. Like,
but number of detentions.
Exactly. Number of traffic citations and arrests. But no.
County searches. Five.
But, I mean, these guys were, like, all super good people. I mean, more than anything else in Aspen, I think that, you know, they didn't have a lot of real serious shit to deal with unless it was actual murders, which happened once a decade and were, like, super high profile. But otherwise, it's just, like, kids getting drunk and them just policing that kind of scene. And they had a great sense of humor.
It's like college almost, though.
Yeah, absolutely. But in,
adult,
like, this
Disneyland.
In adult Disneyland. I mean, that's what it was. And, yeah, so, I mean, those same kind of cops that are handing out trading cards at the Red Bull parties that they come to shut down and inevitably end up hanging out with us and, like, you know, say, oh, you guys got to turn the music down in 10 minutes. And they're still there 2 hours later just, like, shooting the shit with us. Music blasting. You know, their radios are blowing up because, you know, the station's
because there's
cold.
Another party they got to go shut down.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, those same guys were rolling up when we're hitting rails on, like, the Aspen Ski Co. property and just, like, yep, just straight up saying as best they could, like,
I mean,
hands
up. It's a full-on joke.
Yeah, yeah.
But Derek, who puts his hands up?
Oh, everybody did. I mean, in that clip, it just puts their hands in there. It's like, oh, shit.
Like,
oh, should we drop our shovels, officer? But, yeah.
So good.
The chain gang in front of the bus.
Yeah.
What's
so,
up there?
So DNA, Sound North America, they're building a team at that point. And it was like one of the first clothing brands, like following Spider, I think, and Helly Hansen that were trying to, like, really push this new school thing. And I was doing a lot of work with them, and they put together a photo shoot. Because they're based out of Denver. That was, like, where their headquarters was. And they brought everybody out that summer and rented this legit prison bus and got us all in these, like, you know, one-piece jumpsuits and handcuffs and then brought us to Cheeseman Park, which is, incidentally, 3 blocks away from where I live now, which is pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we had this shoot where they, like, paraded us all out of this, like, bus and took photos of us. And people running around the park straight up thought that we were, like, on some sort of, I don't know, like, trash collection, like, civic duty as prisoners. Because, I mean, we're being led around by these two uniformed officers, including Trey Harris, who was, I'm going to say this guy's, like, 6'8", 350. I mean, former college football player, like, a house of a human being, you know, in a full-on, like, police outfit leading us around. And then Dave Crichton, like, makes a break for it and, like, takes off the other direction, like, just as a joke. And there's this dude jogging around in his little blue mini spandex and
bike, you know, shorts
and jogging in bike shorts,
and Crichton just takes off following him. And then this dude turns around, looks over his shoulder, and sees Crichton and just, like, kicks up his knees to his chest, running as fast and furious as he can to get away. And, yeah.
Who brought the goat to the Freeze magazine shoot?
Oh, man.
Chompy the goat.
Chompy the goat.
Mercon,
yeah.
And, Omar Odie.
Yeah, that's right. Where'd you find it? Was Chompy the goat's name in the credits, probably?
Mm-hmm. All
right. Yeah.
If you watch Guatemalan Persuader.
Yep.
Which is their movie. That is like such a deep cut underground ski movie at this point. But there's a whole, it's basically a documentary about the GOAT. I think the beginning of that movie, Glenn Plake blows like an enema.
Oh my god. It is the opening shot of this movie. I'm guessing they put the camera behind like a piece of plexiglass or something.
No.
Glenn Plake says something to the camera, turns around, bends over, and just blasts the camera lens from like a foot away. It's like,
dude,
oh, it's that kind of movie. Right on.
Yeah, there's very few ski movies that have that level of rawness, I would say.
Those
guys were on some serious like extraterrestrial, not taking giving a fuck shit. Like they were like, yeah, they also had this like thing where I think it's Omar or maybe it was Mercon that was like in at Parkosaurus on the massive green wall ride at June was like sitting up top and he's like dropping, like, you know, skier drop in style, and then just like takes a shit.
Like off the wall ride?
Off the top of the wall ride. But they, yeah, that was like this weird thing. That was a funny Parkosaurus because I was like new to that whole scene and meeting a bunch of people at the time. But Nick Mercon had driven from Colorado, I think, with, at some point, I don't know the story at all. This would be better told by those other people that are more in the know, I think, than us. But they had bought a baby goat as a pet.
Why wouldn't you?
And brought it onto the mountain for every day of that shoot. 5 days in a row. And it was like pretty chill. Goats are down as far as like hooved animals go. Like, goats really don't care.
Neither did the Freeze magazine guys.
Yeah, he was like the mascot.
Yeah. Parkosaurus was a special event. I mean, it was like the bastard stepchild of Super Park, which was, dare I say, slightly more serious and legitimate in some ways. And Parkosaurus was just loose. I actually think it was the year before we were still at Snow Summit. I remember checking into the condos, and the Freeze guys had put a pile of VHS midget porn tapes in each of the condos as like the welcome gifts. Like, oh, what is this? And that was their way of just like, instead of like a gift basket with like a bottle of wine and some soap and loofahs, it was midget porn.
Well, I'm on Persuader. Check it out. Find that movie. I don't know if it's online. I'm going to go find out.
YouTube, please. Definitely took it down.
Yeah.
Winterton has a skiing cameo in the credits.
Absolutely. Winterton, prior to becoming the photographer and the East Coast, Ice Coast glue that he was a hell of a skier. He actually spent a few years in Alta, and I think that's where he kind of honed his skills and really kind of ramped up his interest in the ski industry and what we're doing. And you know, that was before my time certainly, but he's known to have hucked some pretty serious cliffs and skied some gnarly lines in Alta back in the day. And yeah, could definitely hold it down. And again, that was like still a point in time where things were so new that, you know, I at that point had really completely given up on my aspirations to be a professional skier because it had, you know, surpassed what I could think about doing. And Jeff was the same, but still early on, like, you know, people on that side of the camera were still comfortable getting on the other side just for fun, like not for serious shot getting purposes, but you know, it was a thing.
And again, he's probably 30 years old, which at the time we're like, I thought he was like, you know, a man, you know, and then now it's like, oh, he's only 30. Like, that's just a number.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're more than capable of doing a double line in Troy, New York, if you know how to ski at 30 years old.
Yep.
But the only other people doing that were like, it was like
Hibbert. 17, 18, 19 year olds. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
it's a pretty ill shot.
Yeah.
It's a straight up like street double line. There's a mute grab off the first hit and a three off the second.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was watching that. That's that is in Troy, New York. I forget what they call it, like the Grand Staircase or something like that. But man, if that's
scenic, it's cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. These granite embankments and stuff,
mm-hmm.
columns, and
yeah.
Like, man, if you got a bunch of snow and went back there today, go nuts.
Yeah.
Mm.
That'd be super cool, just with what's going on in the sport these days. But even just lining up that, it was a double line or a triple line? A triple line. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, but just like thinking about what people do now and could just like tee off on something like that would be nuts.
Mm. There's several Friedel pieces of content in the bonus features of this movie. A feel good video piece. The one of them is called,
yes,
basically a snowboard edit.
Yeah, so that was like my time. That was like a highlight reel of my footage from Tahoe that winter. So moved to South Lake Tahoe, worked at Kirkwood, and my whole thing I was like fascinated with was the backcountry and building jumps and skiing powder and all the lines. And Tahoe at the time was like this epic, like probably the spot to go do that. It was the most famous place to go do that.
Mm.
So that's what dragged us out there. Met a bunch of snowboarders who became friends with. Filming them. Doing
some
stuff.
Big snowboard names in that little bonus feature part. Jake Blauvelt.
Yeah, well, I knew Jake Blauvelt from home, but he had moved to Mammoth that same year and came up to film. Yeah, it was cool. Really cool. Really fun season, hiking off of like Carson Pass and stuff and in the Sierra Nevada.
And a pretty hilarious Bloodhound gang song to go with it.
Yeah, but I showed up to... After filming and been living in Mount Hood all summer, I showed up to Josh's condo where he was starting to edit for it at the end of August, which, like, the edit schedule is way different than it is now. But my main role there, I think, was, like, editing bonus features more than anything else. I edited, the only thing I truly edited besides consulting on some stuff, like the intro was a big consulting move I think I had.
Word.
But
the intro is sick.
Yeah.
It's a big step up, like cinematography, just like the vibe.
The intro goes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It does. It slaps, man. It still slaps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's nice.
Both parts, two-part intro.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Actually, watching that today, I was impressed with the amount of time that's passed to be able to look back and like actually really get something even out of the first part of that intro that is just like setup shots. It's just like people walking around and hanging out and shoveling snow and
still like very
yeah
as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like a very natural kind of just like vibey, like this is kind of like what we were doing.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was definitely cool.
And with that Fugazi guitar, which sets a tone.
Yes, it does.
For sure. And then, like, the Talib track hits hard.
Real hard. Feel the rush.
So.
Feel the rush.
Yeah. But I think I was, like, you were trying to figure out how to use both those songs and what to do.
Yeah.
And I was, like, put the title in the middle.
Mm.
And then you tried it, and it was, like, yes! It was one of those editing breakthroughs. And I was, like, this, yes! Fuck yeah.
It goes.
Remember that lighting shot was just like shot off the porch of that place in Boulder. There's some like crazy electrical storm.
Yeah.
just hanging out shooting B-roll while you edit the movie.
Pretty much. I mean, that's like, oh, cool. We'll throw it in. Yeah. It's like kind of cool. And I got this plug-in that does this like, you know, crazy like ray of light, like pass through perspective thing. So we'll use that too.
Yeah.
That's cool.
We'll step it up.
Throw it in there.
Yeah.
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 Make this like big time. But yeah, I mean, I think I edited Emil's part, my brother's part, for the movie, and then was working. I made the DVD menus, which I took a lot of pride in, and then the special feature. So I had the bonus, like I had the Skis Invisible.
The infomercial.
Infomercial. Which It took a month of my time. Probably a month, cumulatively. But.
Damn.
Yeah.
We tried to post it on Instagram last year.
Oh, yeah.
It was either a year or two ago, and Jay Leventhal sent some email out about inventing, like, invisible skis, and I wanted to do a little repo. I'll be like, Friedel invented invisible skis back in 2003! And because of the Beach Boys track, Instagram and Facebook both just, like, instantaneously took it down. It's like, ah, come on, guys.
You can't use Good Vibrations for free. Nope. You can't put it online. It's on lockdown.
Shocking.
Yeah.
Too bad.
Told me you edited the parts of it where you edit the skis out, frame by frame.
So yeah. That was a direct inspiration from the skateboard movie, Yeah Right, which was a girl, Spike Jonze, Ty Evans thing that had just come out the year. They had done a green screen part where they took out the skateboards. They had green skateboards, and they used motion tracking cameras that would replicate a shot so that, like, you could have a pan shot with a green screen skateboard, and then replicate that shot with nobody in it. So then they could overlay those shots, take out the green screen, put in the neutral behind, and you would have somebody kick-flipping a stair set or, you know, like, ollieing a thing or whatever without a skateboard, which is, like, unbelievably, like, cool looking.
Progressive.
Just, like, it was a gimmicky part in the movie, I think, to real skateboarders. But, like, it was such a dope concept that had never been done before.
Sure.
And I was just, like, so in awe of that movie and that stuff that they had tried. They just were doing, like, random-ass stuff that was cool as hell to me. So I was like, I want to do that for skiing. So very impressionable 18-year-old, you know?
Sure.
Like, I want to do that, too. So... But I didn't have green Alice technology that they used to make it, so I decided
and budget.
Lock off shots, and it was at Mount Hood when Dumont and Crichton were in town, and you take lock off shots of skiing, and then I knew that obviously, like, with Adobe, you can export a video clip into still frames and then re-import those still frames as video. So what I would do is take these 15-second shots or whatever they were, export the still frames into Photoshop, like magic wand or whatever, like the, what's the tool for
clone
it?
Clone stamp?
Not magic wand at all. Clone stamp the snow overlay where the skis are, and then, which took a freaking insane amount of time. So much time per clip. It actually came a cool effect because it wasn't a clean cut out of the skis. It did look like there's something there.
This little, like, force field.
Which almost like a Star Wars-y sort of, like, thing going on, which was, like, really cool. But it took way too much fucking time. And the shots I had were so few because of how time-intensive it was that I need to, like, build this out and make the actual skis invisible, like invisible skis part, like really special. So I built out an infomercial, which I don't know where I got that idea, but I roped steel into it, and then I dressed up in like all these different costumes.
It's an Oscar performance.
Freddie Cotty.
Yeah. I have a really hard time watching it right now because I just cringe at myself. I don't know.
It's funny, man.
I understand that, and it's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm still proud of my effort, I suppose.
For sure.
Man, if we could all look back on things, like, if we're on video at 18 doing stuff like that, like, of course you cringe, but it's.
I also did another...
Nobody's judging.
Yeah. Word. I also am in the credits all over the place, like, doing my best Tyrone Biggums, which is the Dave Chappelle show, crackhead character. Ow! Parker, this hot! He was scratching his neck, feeding for next. But
his next editing job. We'll make ski movies for food.
Yeah. So that was my other ripoff.
Shot all over Boulder that summer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dope.
Yeah. That was the year the Chappelle Show came out. Huge cultural impact. Yeah.
Those couple bonus features are just as much as the movie is, like, an awesome marker of the times, in a way. Like, to see what was going on in the sport. and in movie making in the sport. It's cool to me.
The illest part about DVDs was the bonus features.
Absolutely.
Because you could really like talk some extra stuff that would be peripheral to the movie or not have anything to do really with the movie or whatever.
Right.
Like the skis and his ball.
Right.
But you just have it on there, extra entertainment. Mm-hmm. You could do whatever the fuck you wanted.
I love it.
Yeah. It's fun times. Had some good years with bonus features.
and hidden bonus features.
And hidden bonus features.
Anything else you guys want to bring up, talk about, discuss?
Oh, man, one note I have here. Looking at the list of sponsors in the credits.
Okay.
It just reminds me of how scrappy we had to be at that time, where we're shooting with Simon Dumont and Peter Legg, and they're both Salomon athletes, and Salomon, I think, was, you know, writing some pretty big checks to Poor Boys and probably Matchstick as well. And I mean, there were literally no scraps left for us. And
to those two dudes,
maybe. I mean, for sure, a little bit. I think so.
Definitely as it goes on.
Oh yeah, some funny stories about that too. We'll tell you in the next couple episodes. But certainly, you know, we had to do whatever we could. And so Salomon, and talking to them, they have no money left over for me. And so somehow I got into this situation where it's like, well, if you guys send me skis to sell, then, I mean, that's better than nothing. Because these skis cost you know, pennies-ish on the dollar. And
relative to what you're selling them for. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, I mean, Salomon skis at the time were in particular high demand. And I think it might have even started the year before where maybe they sent me like a dozen pair of skis and bindings. I want to say it might have gone into like high five where it really went crazy. But I mean, eventually, a couple of years down the line, between what I was doing with Salomon and Vocal and maybe one other company, we were selling like 30 or 40 pair of skis. And it was like a full-time eBay operation.
It was a hustle.
Yeah. And I remember like one year in particular thinking like, we've probably sold more skis than some small ski shops have. And like, that's what we had to do to survive. But it's definitely funny looking at like the list. Yeah, Salomon got logo placement for a bunch of product.
Hanson Energy.
And Hanson Energy, that was some weird deal with Scott Hollywood Sepkovic, who was the spy team manager the year prior. And, you know, he had his fingers in the pie of a bunch of different brands that he was consulting with and working for. And yeah, Hanson's Energy, we signed a contract with them for $5,000. I think it took 3 years to get that check.
No shit. It's
not cool.
It tasted like Mountain Dew.
Yeah.
I've seen Hanson Soda. Is this the same thing?
Same idea. Yeah.
Rough.
And I think it was actually the summer that we were editing Forward, where is that when we came up? Like, so Super Unknown was 2004. Okay, yeah, but that's when we conceptualized Super Unknown. Was the summer that I was still living in Boulder, I'm pretty sure. And so we probably launched it that fall that we were shooting for High Five. Yeah, I think
I don't know how much that applies to Ford, because that would have been the next after Ford
sure.
was done.
Sure, but I just remember still being in Boulder when I came up with that idea.
100%.
Because remember, Shayna worked on the graphic with me and helped me, like, that was my girlfriend at the time.
Yeah, I saw in the credits.
We all know how well that worked out. But yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I definitely remember from my time in Boulder was coming up with the concept for Super Unknown. We can get into that a little more later.
Sure.
That plays a role in many years to come, for sure.
Every year to come.
Yeah.
In some ways.
Yep.
The one thing I wanted to bring up was, so when, I mean, I know it from like what I was like brought into, but when Strike 3 would have been the last movie, at what point did you decide we're going forward here, so to speak, and yeah,
we're gonna make another.
Yeah, and
after having thought Strike 3
sure,
would be the last
absolutely.
One too.
Well, we got to the end of Strike 3 as far as like making a movie, and it was hard to like get off the train, so to speak, at that point, because we all felt you know, as a crew, pretty good about what we were doing. And, you know, like the movie comes out, or we finish the movie, you know, at that point, probably in like late September, early October or something like that, and do a couple little premieres, and all of a sudden the snow starts falling again. And before you know it, it's like, oh man, snow's falling. We gotta go shoot some rails. And I mean, it would just happen like that. And there wasn't, I mean, I definitely remember thinking about like, do we want to make another one? Is this what I want to do? But then it's like, well, I'll deal with that later. I gotta go shoot. And there was no like definitive, like, all right, like I am never gonna go to New York or LA. I'm definitely gonna just continue to do this. It just kind of happened. Because we'd never decided to stop it, really. And it was just this very organic thing.
And you were on the hamster wheel.
I was definitely on the hamster wheel. Yeah. And, you know, I think I might have mentioned it early on, too, but, like, I think one of the reasons why we were successful is because we never had some sort of definitive business plan and ambitions. We're just kind of rolling with it. And that's what allowed us to just keep it going and never really overextended ourselves and just kind of like kept it real.
It's like a carousel. Goes up, down, and around.
It sure does. That's funny though, I do remember.
And there's music.
I remember sitting in my ex's dorm room and like trying to come up with names. And initially, like going through like a thesaurus, and it was like, all right, well, we've done second generation now, and we did strike three, so we should do something with a four in it. Like, that would be cool. And we should just like embrace this numerical thing. And so it's like, all right, it's got to have a four in it. And that was the same year that Matt Sturbins announced that he was making Forefront Skis as a brand. I remember he came up to me in the parking lot at the Saratoga Springs, New York Rail Jam. And it was probably the summer before, I think, because he had finally had skis that year. And he's like, man, I just made the stupidest decision I've ever made in my life. I'm starting a ski company.
Sick.
And yeah, so that was Forefront. It's like, what can we do? And then in this thesaurus, there was an abbreviation, F-O-R, with periods. There was like this late 1800s adaptation for Freedom on Rails, which referred to people hitchhiking on train cars.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, this is cool because it applies to like skiing. So we're going to call it FOR for Freedom on Rails.
That would be so funny if that movie was called Freedom on Rails.
And like for a little while,
FOR.
I definitely remember these mock-ups that Shayna put together.
This sounds big. FOR
with like a period after each one. And it like obviously didn't go too far. And it's like, nah, you know, we're just going to call it Forward. Like, that's, you know, whatever. But definitely for a while, it's like, yeah, Freedom on Rails. It's like
Freedom on Rails, word.
It's like triple entendre of stupid names. Glad we did not do that. We say the stupid name for a couple years later.
But you made a pitch to me at some point. Because you needed a filmer. I don't know exact. I think I know where I was. You must have sent me an email or a text. No, not text. Way before cell phone.
I paged you.
Maybe an IM.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, I don't know. But I remember sitting in my buddy's house and it was like, yeah, you were like, are you interested? I'm going to continue this and make a new movie. And are you interested in filming for me? Because I need more than myself, basically.
Yeah.
And
need a number two.
Yeah, and I think you had basically lined out that I was like, I'll basically buy you a camera, which ultimately is what happened. But I remember, obviously, like that I had already had my plan of the just going and skiing, but that fit into it very nicely for sure. But I was like, oh, we should make like a team movie with Dean Star with like Crichton and Liam and all these guys, because that was like the hot team at the time.
Oh yeah,
coming off of Royalty and all these other movies. But obviously not what happened. But I think that's what I immediately responded with. So it turned into something completely different, but that was definitely a big jumping point. I mean, obviously for myself, but
yeah. Well, I think for all of us, because that's when, you know, I really made the commitment to move out west.
Yeah.
As did you in one way, shape, or form. And I mean, that was a commitment to pursue this. And it was like, all right, we're not going to hang in Vermont anymore.
No. Did a bunch of rails though that year.
Oh, yeah.
In the East. But
as dorky as Freedom on Rails and FOR might have been, I actually like that a lot, especially coming here to Boulder, which is in Denver, which is like the center of Jack Kerouac's On the Road. Like, and that was the motto for a long time. It's just like on the road.
Yeah.
Freedom on Rails.
That's another level of meaning that I didn't really embrace at the time. That in retrospect, I mean, we're just traveling because that's what we did. And it wasn't like this very conscious, like liberating, creative, like vibing thing. It was like, this is what we had to do. But that's very introspective. I like that.
Mm. Our next movie was also supposed to be called Dharma Bums, but scratched out.
A few copyright issues there. sick. Anything else?
I think that covers it for now.
Yep.
Hell yeah.
On to the next.
Awesome.
On to the next.
Good movie, though.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoy
it. Go watch it.
Enjoy the movie.
Yo, thanks for listening. That was episode 4, Forward. Real quick, run back those ways to support. Check out the Level 1 newsletter. It's on the Level 1 website, level1.ski. Give us a follow on the gram if you don't already, at Level 1. Summer sale, August 1st. Level 1 movie night at the office, 916 Inca, August 2nd. Romance premiere, September 21st. So make sure you got your calendar out, writing on those dates. And tell your homies, tell your friends. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week for High Five.